Today is Wednesday, August 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, an accident or act of terrorism? That's the question following a devastating explosion in the heart of Beirut, Lebanon.
It was massive. It's like a volcano. So it was something that I never experienced in my life.
Analysts say President Trump's demand for the U.S. cut of a TikTok deal is unprecedented.
I find it incredibly counterproductive and frankly very dangerous.
Also ahead, a legendary American rocker is suing the Trump campaign. It's all on today's International Edition. A massive explosion rocked Beirut on Tuesday, flattening much of the city's port, damaging buildings across the capital. More than 70 people were killed and about 3,000 injured, with bodies buried in the rubble. The sudden devastation overwhelmed a country already struggling with both the coronavirus pandemic and an economic crisis. The cause is still under investigation. Joining us now is Emily Hawthorne, Middle East and North Africa analyst for Stratfor. Lebanon has really been through some tough things, including a civil war, but the enormity of this in the city of Beirut is really unprecedented. Is that pretty safe to say?
I think even the Beirut governor, in one of his interviews, has said that this is a catastrophic event like Beirut has not seen. And Beirut, in particular, and Lebanon as a country, have been through quite a lot, many conflicts, many crises, many disasters. But an explosion of this magnitude, causing this many casualties, and with so much uncertain about exactly what caused it, I do think that this is an unprecedented event.
And of course, it's in the middle of a pandemic, which is certainly also adding to the horror of the situation.
The hospitals in Lebanon, and certainly in Beirut, a dense city within Lebanon, the hospitals are already strained. They're already at capacity. There are so many injured across the city right now that there are many reports of people being turned away for medical care from shrapnel wounds and the like. So this is a city that was already at a breaking point with respect to its healthcare system, and this is going to pile extra misery on top of that. And I think hopefully open up opportunities in the near term for external allies of Lebanon and private donors to get involved to sort of help that immediate need.
Israel has already denied having anything to do with this. Is there any indication that this was intentional, that this could have been terrorism or vice versa, that it could have been some sort of horrible fireworks accident?
At this moment, I think we should be taking what Israeli officials are saying at face value. They've said that they have nothing to do with this. They, even though they are engaged in a long-standing struggle against Hezbollah, which has a role in the Lebanese government, and which has been known to store ammunition and to have materiel throughout the country, we have no reason to believe that this incident is related to that long-standing conflict. Again, things are not totally clear at this moment, but most signs are pointing to this being a horrendous accident and likely a result of negligence on the part of authorities that were in charge of managing things at this port.
When you say managing things, you mean munitions?
There's a lot that remains uncertain about this incident, mm-hmm. but it is very possible that there were explosive materials. Ammonium nitrate is one source of the explosion, according to some Lebanese security officials, that there were high amounts of ammonium nitrate stored in this area that ignited. And it's not clear exactly why that happened, exactly why such materials would be there. But in terms of managing storage of materials at the port, managing, you know, what is stored where, that's something that there's going to be a lot of questions about in the coming days, weeks, and months, and a lot of finger pointing politically over who is responsible for the safety of the Beirut port.
I guess what I'm hearing is we really don't know at this point what happened, but the possibility that this was not intentional and that it was an accident is still something that could be the case, is what I'm hearing.
I think it's very possible that this was a horrific industrial accident. That doesn't mean that there won't be important questions about culpability, you know, who is behind making sure that this port facility is secured and does not have massive amounts of dangerous material close to residential areas. And again, right now, according to the Lebanese government, it is high amounts of ammonium nitrate that exploded, and that's the cause of the explosion. We're really going to have to wait and see in the days and the weeks to come what actually ignited, what actually happened, and sort of what led to an explosion of this magnitude, because it's not clear at this moment. The Lebanese are already very angry at their government and angry at inefficiencies and ineptitudes. And this incident is only going to increase popular anger at the government and increase the demand for there to be some change within the government that makes them more accountable to the Lebanese people in terms of their economic and physical safety and security.
Emily Hawthorne, Middle East and North Africa analyst with Stratfor, a rain company. Thank you so much for being with us. The U.S. is approaching 5 million confirmed cases of the coronavirus, far outpacing other countries. Experts say Americans are resisting taking steps to avoid getting infected. Many of the hotspots are chalked up to large gatherings, from big house parties and large no-mask weddings to crowded bars and restaurants. The U.S. has had more than 155,000 people die from the virus in just a matter of months. U.S. President Donald Trump is suggesting if the planned sale of video app TikTok goes through with the Microsoft Corporation, the government should get a cut. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin recently confirmed that the app is being reviewed by the department's Committee on Foreign Investment in the U.S., also known as CFIUS. International Edition's Steve Miller spoke to Martin Shorzempa, a research fellow at the Peterson Institute of International Economics, about the president's statement and what exactly is the role of CFIUS.
CFIUS stands for the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States. And essentially what it is a group chaired by the Treasury Department of the United States government, but also including defense and other areas. And the idea is that they review any investment by a foreigner into American businesses that they think might harm national security. And they have the power to ultimately make recommendations to the president, who can then decide to, for example, block a deal. If a deal has been made and hasn't been reported to them, and they decide later that it harms national security, which seems to be in this ByteDance TikTok case, the issue at hand, they can actually unwind that deal. And in between those two options, there's also an ability to impose mitigation measures. So they might, for example, say, you know, the foreign company can buy the U.S. company, but they can't get access to some sensitive data. That's a piece of it. And what's important context here is that for a long time, CFIUS had a pretty limited remit, in meaning that they were more focused on, you know, buying missile technology, things related to nuclear or arms manufacturing, or say real estate right next to a military base. They weren't really focused on technology companies, but it's really been in the past few years that they've really started to look at technology and its connection to national security in areas that you might not think are national security in the past.
Now, we're talking about, as you mentioned, TikTok and ByteDance, the parent corporation here in the United States. And you also touched on that this is all about acquisition of technology and corporations. Now, ByteDance was operating here in the U.S. Would CFIUS really come into play because it is a foreign company operating here? Is this something that CFIUS would have been looking at before all the controversy?
CFIUS only has jurisdiction when a U.S. business is purchased. And in the TikTok case, it relates to ByteDance's acquisition of Musical.ly in 2017, which was an American business that was being bought by a foreign business. So that's ultimately the source of the jurisdiction here. If Microsoft is buying TikTok, Microsoft being an American company, it would not be subject to CFIUS jurisdiction.
So then when the president comes out and says if Microsoft is allowed to go through and purchase ByteDance, which is operating TikTok here, and the Treasury should get a big cut of that sale, where does that fall in the jurisdiction and the purview of CFIUS?
It falls nowhere in the purview of CFIUS, and it frankly smacks of mafia tactics. There is nothing in the law and practice of CFIUS up until this point that suggests that the American government should get a cut of anything. It's only supposed to be focused on mitigation of national security concerns. It's not about making a buck for the U.S. Treasury. It's not really about protectionism for American companies. It's ultimately supposed to be about keeping Americans safe. And this kind of rhetoric really undermines the work that people at CFIUS do in trying to be above the political fray and trying not to be protectionist, but to really help protect national security. So I find it incredibly counterproductive and frankly very dangerous, because the U.S. is trying to get other countries to adopt CFIUS-like measures to protect their own economies. And if those end up demanding shakedown payments, they could end up applying the same kind of shakedown to American companies that are operating there and say, you know, an American, they could say Microsoft has to divest its local subsidiary and sell it to some local firm at a discount and pocket it. That's a pretty bad looking world for the mixing of politics and business.
Does that pose a greater threat to globalism as a business model then?
Absolutely. What we really don't want is a balkanization where companies are not really able to operate globally and they rely on the local government to protect them, kind of like a protection racket. What you want is legal regimes that are careful and truly balance national security and with the openness that has created the kind of prosperity and innovation that we have now. And I think there's not much to be gained to separate this out. And what's been especially concerning about this case has been that there seems to be an emphasis from the White House on it being an American company that buys it. You know, and in my view, you know, if a security ally of the United States, if it's say a Korean, a Japanese, a French, a German, a British company, all of that should be fine. I don't see any reason why it should have to be an American company that buys this. Just as we hope that countries like India and blocs like the EU don't decide that only a Facebook owned by a local company is acceptable to them.
Martin Shore-Zempa, research fellow with the Peterson Institute of International Economics, speaking with International Edition's Steve Miller. Here are some of the other stories we are following at VOA. Tropical storm Isaias triggered rare tornadoes and knocked out power as it raced up the U.S. East Coast Tuesday, killing at least one man in New York City and two others in North Carolina, where a tornado obliterated a mobile home park. The fast-moving storm overturned cars, flooded streets, and toppled power lines, leaving at least 1.4 million customers without electricity from North Carolina all the way up to New York. The U.S. envoy to Venezuela said Tuesday the Trump administration will maintain support for opposition leader Juan Guaido as Venezuela's legitimate president and expects dozens of other countries to continue recognizing him following December 6th legislative elections that opposition parties plan to boycott. Elliot Abrams, the U.S. special representative on Venezuela, made the commitment to Guaido 2 days after 27 opposition parties announced they would not participate in the elections, saying they would be rigged by President Nicolas Maduro's ruling Socialist Party. China vowed Tuesday to retaliate if the U.S. persists with what it calls, quote, hostile action against Chinese journalists who may be forced to leave in the coming days if their U.S. visas are not extended. A Chinese foreign ministry spokesman told reporters no Chinese journalist in the U.S. so far has been granted a visa extension since the United States on May 11th limited their stay to 90 days with an option to extend. As the pandemic rages and weakens fragile societies, terrorists lie in wait to pounce on vulnerable people, especially on the African continent. That according to a top U.S. military commander. U.S. military officials say their work on the continent has continued unabated, but that extremists are actively seeking every opportunity to gain a foothold from Senegal to Somalia. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Violent extremist organizations, or VEOs, are seizing on Africa's coronavirus chaos to advance their goals in vulnerable societies, from Nigeria to Mozambique, says the head of U.S. Special Operations Command Africa, Major General Dagvin Anderson. He spoke to reporters via Zoom video conference from AFRICOM headquarters in Stuttgart, Germany.
I do believe the extremists will look to exploit any opportunity they get, and COVID presents those opportunities because COVID stresses any government. We know the governments in these in the nations of Africa are also feeling that stress, and the VEOs will look to exploit that. I can't tell you exactly how, because that will manifest itself in different ways in each of these countries. But these VEOs are very dynamic, and they're very flexible, and they will look to see where those weak points are or where that can be exploited, and they will go after it.
In West Africa, Islamist extremists have shut down educational systems. Anderson cited more than 3,000 schools shuttered by extremist groups in Mali and Burkina Faso. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, Central African Republic, and Mozambique, they've harnessed local grievances to feed their activities. And he said some of these groups count on foreign assistance from mercenary groups with murky affiliations. The shadowy Wagner Group is thought to be active in as many as 20 African countries, including Mozambique, Libya, Sudan, the Ivory Coast, and the Central African Republic. Anderson echoed analysts who believe the Wagner Group is closely connected to the Kremlin, a charge the Kremlin has denied.
Russia is directly engaged with them. I see them as being very corrosive. I see them as being detrimental to what should be a common international threat. Unfortunately, what we see is they're fueling the conflict in Libya. To say that that is a private military contractor, I think, is a bit of a stretch, because they're bringing in weapon systems that we saw recently reported in the press that private companies just don't have access to. Those are state-provided weapon systems.
Anderson also touched on the recent announcement that U.S. Africa Command headquarters would move out of Germany to another European nation. He noted that the disruptions of the coronavirus crisis didn't change or diminish U.S. operations in Africa, and reasoned that a change of headquarters would have little effect on their work. What worries him more, he said, is the pandemic's disastrous effect on government services and institutions in Africa. And he noted the military's role is limited and often too late.
We are often the firemen, that if you're calling the firefighters, it means the fire has already broken out, and that we need to do things to do fire prevention, and we need to be able to cut fire breaks to keep that fire from spreading. While I appreciate everyone's interest in what the military brings, if you're ringing the fire alarm, it's probably a little late. We need to do things ahead of it in order to prevent.
Right now, the American general said, families and communities across the world face uncertainty and fear as the coronavirus continues to spread. A military solution alone will not address their needs for food security, schools, decent health care, and basic government services. Some extremist groups say they arose specifically to address those injustices. But, Anderson said, their violent methods are a dead end. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Arab and Syrian government media are reporting a series of Israeli airstrikes over the Golan Heights and near the Syrian border with Iraq. Over a dozen pro-Iranian Iraq militiamen were reportedly killed at a base near the Syrian border town of Al-Bukamel. Russian planes also reportedly raided areas around the opposition-held enclave of Idlib. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Syrian TV reported that Israeli warplanes carried out a number of airstrikes over the region of Quneitra on the Golan Heights following what Israel said was an attempted attack Monday by four pro-Syrian militia fighters on the Israeli-held territory. Israeli tanks carried out maneuvers near the border with Lebanon and Syria during the past 24 hours amid tensions with the pro-Iranian Hezbollah group. Arab media reports say that Hezbollah is seeking to retaliate for the killing last month of one of its commanders in an Israeli raid near Damascus. Rami Abdulrahman of the Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights told Arab media that about 15 pro-Iranian Iraqi militia fighters were killed in a separate Israeli airstrike on an Iranian base near the eastern Syrian border town of Al-Bukamel. He says that Israel has carried out nearly 20 raids on Syrian territory in the past 4 months. In separate developments, Russian warplanes targeted Syrian opposition forces over the town of Binish near the opposition enclave of Idlib, according to the Saudi-owned Ashark al-Awsat newspaper. Casualties also were reported in fighting between government forces and opposition fighters on the outskirts of Latakia. Clashes were reported outside of Deir Zor in eastern Syria between Arab villagers and U.S.-backed Kurdish forces following the death of an Arab tribal leader. Syrian government TV says a second Arab tribal leader was wounded. Kurdish media says Islamic State fighters killed the tribal leader to provoke violence. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
The International Labor Union's Convention on the Worst Forms of Child Labor has, for the first time ever, received unanimous ratification from all of its members that all children will have legal protection. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
An estimated 152 million children are in child labor. 73 million are involved in hazardous work that the International Labor Organization defines as the worst forms of child labor. ILO Director General Guy Ryder says the universal ratification of the convention means that children now will benefit from critical legal protection against the worst forms of child labor.
In the past, it has too often been the lot of children to be used to fight in armed conflict, to be sold as slaves, forced into work in the drug trade or in the production of child sexual abuse material, or exposed to hazardous substances and long hours. In every country, now these practices have been condemned and clear legal prohibitions against them have been established everywhere.
However, Ryder warns against complacency. He says countries must do more to end impunity for violators and for violations of children's right to be free from child labor. He says governments must implement and enforce the provisions in the convention. Since the ILO Convention was adopted in 1999, the incidence of child labor and its worst forms dropped nearly 40% by 2016. However, progress has slowed in recent years, particularly among children 5 to 11 years of age and in some geographical areas. Africa is the region with both the highest absolute number of child laborers and the highest prevalence. Ryder tells VOA the situation in Africa is very worrying.
Just over 72 million African children are in child labor, and of those, 31.5 million in hazardous work. The prevalence rate then is nearly 20%. Nearly one in five of all African children are in child labor. Progress seems to have stalled in Africa, and child labor in absolute terms actually increased in sub-Saharan Africa from 2012 to 2016.
The ILO chief fears years of progress in reducing child labor are at risk of being reversed by COVID-19. He notes the pandemic has caused global unemployment to skyrocket. As more and more people lose their livelihoods and means of survival, he says the danger and temptation to push children back into the labor market will grow. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to International Edition. Stay with us. Back in a minute.
What's going on, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. Join us each week on Upfront as we discuss a range of topics. The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
Eliminate the mentality that girls cannot do what boys can do.
You basically need to go to school. There's just no way you're going to get all the skills that people want from you or they expect from you if you're not at school.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Can the AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
Border Crossings.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London.
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour. Oh. Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. win prizes, and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews. Ooh. Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA. Or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world. Ah. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. A French astronaut is set to become the first European to fly to the International Space Station aboard the SpaceX Dragon capsule. VOA's David Byrd tells us Thomas Pesquet is set to fly next spring.
Last Sunday, the SpaceX capsule with American astronauts Bob Behnken and Doug Hurley splashed down in the Gulf of Mexico. It was the first time an American vehicle had successfully delivered astronauts to the International Space Station since the shuttle program ended. Now, SpaceX will take European Space Agency astronaut Thomas Pesquet to the ISS. The mission will be Pesquet's second to the International Space Station after he spent 196 days in space. He journeyed to the ISS on board a Russian Soyuz spacecraft in November of 2016 and returned in June of 2017. But the French astronaut says the state-of-the-art Dragon capsule is vastly different from the Russian craft.
Because it's been designed with everything you can have as far as technology nowadays in the modern times. Soyuz dates back to the 60s, 70s, and again, very reliable, but Crew Dragon, it's big flat screens. The controls are very different from what you find in an aircraft, even a modern one. So it's really futuristic in a way, and that's exciting.
NASA astronauts Shane Kimbrough and Megan MacArthur and Japanese astronaut Akihiko Hoshide will join Pesquet at the ISS. This year marks 20 years of continuous human presence on the space station. 240 people from 19 countries have visited the unique microgravity lab. Pesquet says that shows how successful the space station program has been.
People from all over the world, different countries, have put together their resources for peaceful purposes, for science, for research, for progress. And it's been going on for 20 years, and it's an amazing success. So to me, this is simply the biggest source of inspiration across the world for research, for progress, for discovery, and for inspiration of the new generation.
The French astronaut is scheduled to spend about 6 months on the ISS and will conduct spacewalks, experiments, and other work. But he says he is most looking forward to the view from space.
The thing I'm the most looking forward to is just getting that view of the Earth again, because it's so beautiful that I'm still dreaming about it 3 years after my landing.
Pesquet has been training for his flight at NASA's Johnson Space Center in Houston, Texas. The launch is tentatively scheduled for March of 2021. I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
Singer Neil Young sued U.S. President Donald Trump's re-election campaign on Tuesday, accusing it of copyright infringement for playing the rocker's songs without permission. In a complaint in the lawsuit filed in U.S. District Court in Manhattan, Young objected to the playing of Rockin' in the Free World and Devil's Sidewalk numerous times at rallies and political events, including a June 20th rally in Tulsa, Oklahoma. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thanks so much for listening. The same old town doesn't...
This is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.